Wisconsin's Afternoon News is on the air, broadcasting live from the Annex Wealth Management Studios at The Avenue in beautiful downtown Milwaukee. Here are your hosts, John McCure and Julia Fellow.
The always predictable Julia Fellow and John McCure with you on a Friday. Hope your Friday's going great.
All I said was that I texted someone and both the boys were like, whoa.
Oh, wow.
What did you text? I'm like,
it was nice.
Nothing.
And then you said, am I that unpredictable? And I said, no, it's predictable.
I said, am I that scary?
You're not scary, for sure. If you want to see what we're talking about, you can always watch us on YouTube. YouTube. We're on there.
You can check out Adam, too.
Yep. Adam's in here.
Hello, everyone.
With a preview of Reporter's Notebook.
How about it? It is a Friday. We're doing it an hour early because we got Brewers tonight. But we got another great episode coming up this week. And so here's a question for both you two, because you've both spent time in Illinois over the years. When's the last time you picked up a copy or...
It's just great to see those guys coming back, and they're so...
Well, I think I just heard Matt Arnold chiming in on the conversation, too.
Did you rudely? When was the last time you were asking that we what?
So you two have some Illinois background. Yes. When's the last time you either, whether it was online or just holding it, scanned the Chicago Tribune?
I've looked at the Tribune a couple times a month. So I looked at it maybe 3 weeks ago.
Okay. Julia?
Why are you telling us that? Why are you, like, outing that we're fibs? What's that about?
If you know, you know.
My husband is from Wisconsin Rapids, and I've lived here probably more than in...
All right, Julia, you got great Wisconsin credentials. When
Chicago
did you...
Tribune was extremely high-end. That was, like, what got me into journalism. I have not touched it since I was going into the train system into downtown Chicago in 2008.
Okay, but the Tribune... Paper of record for the state of Illinois, been around since 1846. Tribune Tower, a lot of history with this paper.
Yes.
And in the basements of old Tribune Tower for years, for five stories underground, there was an archive of old negative photos, historical documents, data, maps, all sorts of collections. Now, they've moved to different locations over the years, but that archive still exists. And so someone has to comb through all of that, usually for stories that require historical context, especially if you're going back to the 1800s with some of this. So I spoke this week with Corey Rumor. She's a visual journalist at the Tribune and also is the person who's hands-on in those archives every single day. And what's so fascinating is because I love history as much as, John, you also are a big aficionado of historical facts. And so one of the things we always say about history is that those who do not learn it are doomed to repeat it. So history is a valuable tool for us, and Corey explains how she used that in regards to studying up on the 1979 crash of Flight 191 in Des Plaines, Illinois, which, fun fact, well, not fun, but it's a fact, is to this day still the largest loss of life in a plane crash outside 9/11 in U.S. history.
It's a really good way to make sure people aren't statistics, to make sure, you know, we tell the lives of people who've, even though they've long been gone, they haven't been forgotten. And it's still relevant now because there's going to be construction on the site near O'Hare International Airport. And of course, people are speaking out about it. They're not happy about it. And so I've been able to revisit it, not just for the sake of an anniversary, but for the sake that it's still newsworthy, and to bring up some of those the lessons of what we learned from the crash, but also to make sure the family and the friends of the victims still have a say, still feel heard with what happens at that crash site.
And you know Corey is an expert on all things Chicago Tribune history, because when we were having our conversation this week, we did it over a Teams call. And she was wearing her Dewey Defeats Truman Chicago Tribune shirt with Truman holding up the paper.
Yeah.
So, I mean, big moment, and also an admission that sometimes paper gets it wrong, and it's good to document that stuff.
All right, so Reporter's Notebook, give us the time. Give us the
Sundays, 10 a.m. We'll have the podcast up for you to listen in full in just a couple of hours.
All right, Adam Roberts. Thanks, Adam.
Of course.
I'll be listening.
If you're driving while listening to Wisconsin's Afternoon News, you're likely driving past an area under roadway construction. There's many campaigns out there to be careful. And I want to bring to light something that just happened last night in Madison. This is by the Quick Trip just west of Lake Monona. There was a construction worker who was putting out cones, a 23-year-old. He was struck by a vehicle, killed. The vehicle took off. The Quick Trip had surveillance footage, and they have the person, the suspect, not officially charged, now in custody. And now someone's life is gone. So there's an organization, the Wisconsin Transportation Builders Association, Steve Boss. He's been bringing to light, I mean, we just were on last week, right?
Yeah, less than a week or just over a week ago, I was in here. It's always great to see you. Yeah. I didn't want to be back this soon on a topic this serious.
I know. What is your reaction to this? I mean, this is what you're doing every day, is to bring awareness. And this happened 10 o'clock just last night.
Yeah. And, you know, there was another one yesterday in the afternoon. A utility worker on Highway 20 was struck and killed down in Troy. So I mean, last week I was in here, we were talking about the eight cones shrouded in black in our work zone, or the seven cones shrouded in black on our work zone awareness week for the people who had died. And I said, our goal this year is zero cones. And
right.
Within 8 days, yeah, we have two deaths in a work zone. And my initial, I think everybody's initial reaction is sadness, but then I'm just mad. I'm just mad. It's so frustrating. And we've got two lives lost, and then two lives completely altered by this. I mean, the perpetrators of it, the distracted drivers, their lives are ruined now too, you know, in a different way. But I mean, the cost is so big, and it's so avoidable. It's just very sad, but also maddening.
And the families of both of those lives have been altered forever. So, Steve, I have been hearing these radio ads. It's the voice of a guy talking about this. I've seen billboards where I've seen a billboard where I think it shows a construction worker with his family wearing the vest. How effective is that in trying to reach people and ask them to slow down, take it easy, be safe?
People are getting the message, but you have to internalize that message and actually act on it. And we can do a lot on awareness. We put those billboards up. The department does the ads. We do a whole week of different events. We had the Hone Bridge lit orange last week, for heaven's sake. And the awareness is there. And I think people know it at the surface level. It's internalizing it and letting it affect their behavior is the jump we need to make. And it's hard. People's minds are on other things. Everybody's in a rush. But, you know, last week and in the signs, the billboards you talk about, we really appeal to empathy.
Yeah,
you know, put yourselves in the shoes of those workers. I think we need to remind people to appeal to self-interest, too. I mean, the seven deaths last year were actually motorists in those construction zone accidents. Again, as I said before, you know, not to belittle the loss of life, but those drivers involved in those accidents yesterday and today, their lives are completely turned upside down and ruined, too. You have families there who will lose their father,
yep,
because he'll be in jail. There is a self-interest aspect along with an empathy aspect that people need to appreciate, and we just got to be kinder with each other and look out for each other. You know, slow down. Nothing is worth this sort of disruption.
Yeah, we have Steve Boss with us with Wisconsin Transportation Builders Association. I really appreciate, I was just driving on 94 going east, and I saw the billboard. It says, slow down. That guy in the vest is our dad.
Yeah.
And he's wearing a yellow vest like you're talking about. And it's a six-year-old and his newborn. That is so powerful. And it's things like that that your organization is trying to do. WorkZoneSafe.com. Can you talk about that? WorkZoneSafe.com.
Yeah, WorkZoneSafe.com is an online work zone safety course that we developed. And we wanted to get to drivers while they're learning. And so we developed this work zone safety course. It has a lot of very personal stories and very personal examples of safe driving behavior. And also the ripple effects, the unfortunate ripple effects from unsafe behavior. So we created that with teen drivers in mind. And then we changed the law here in Wisconsin to require that every teen driver going through driver ed have a work zone safety unit in it. And this online course satisfies that requirement. So, you know, as I said last week, the tree grows the direction the twig is bent. We want to instill those habits early. But it's something that I really think no matter what your age, it's a good reminder. You see this stuff, it makes it real to you, and you're reminded to think a little bit deeper about how your behavior is impacting others.
What do the trends show? Are we doing better? Are there less deaths and injuries? Are there less accidents? Are there more? What do the last 5 years or so look like?
Well, last year we had over 600 accidents, work zone accidents.
Wow.
We had over 2,000 work zone accidents. We had over 600 injuries, people injured in those. The numbers are a little better from the Nader, which was in COVID. During COVID, it was Wild West out there. So the numbers have improved a little bit, but they are still way too high, and they have kind of flatlined from that initial recovery after COVID, and we're off to a rough start this year.
So this is the time of year where we have construction zones. I know that everybody knows their neighborhoods like the back of their hands. I get it. But things can change. The roads can change. Even I-94, for 7 years, it will change through the entire construction time. So please be aware there are lives, there are people on the roadways trying to make it better. And it's not all about us. We need to make sure that we're looking out for each other and keep your head on a swivel. Go to workzonesafe.com. Even adults can do it, John. Workzonesafe.com. Steve Boss with the Wisconsin Transportation Builders Association. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you. And thanks for bringing attention to this. It obviously is heartbreaking when we hear these incidents. It's this sort of constant reminder that's going to change attitudes, change behaviors, and change lives in the long run.
We appreciate it, Steve. Thank you. All right, so you heard in the sports there, Brandon Woodruff on the 15-day injured list, right shoulder inflammation. Interesting, he said he had no velocity on his fastball yesterday, but he said he didn't feel pain when he came out of the game, but clearly knew that something wasn't right. He said he had dead arm is what it felt like. What is that? What does that mean? Dr. Patrick Yost, Orthopedic Hospital of Wisconsin, is with us. Dr. Yost, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you deal with elite athletes all the time, and you deal with arms as part of what you do. Let's start with the broad question of what is dead arm? What does this likely mean is going on?
So that can mean a lot of things. So the most common time I hear it is when a pitcher will blow out their elbow and they'll say, I felt a pop and then my arm was dead. Usually that means they've torn their ulnar collateral ligament. Now, in Brandon's case, his elbow's fine. He's just trying to describe that he has a painless arm that just doesn't generate the velocity he's expecting. And if you watch the game or if you kind of read his responses, it was sort of like, it's not doing what I'm expecting, but it's not hurting. And then he tried again, and it still wasn't doing what he was expecting just from velocity. And so they just called it and pulled him out. But to me, that means velocity wasn't there, but there also wasn't like a pop or pain or anything. So that's not the usual, that's not a very common way of describing a dead arm. Usually a dead arm is like skull and crossbones, something terrible happened.
Wow. So he's now on the 15-day injured list with right shoulder inflammation. Now, how bad is that? Because, I mean, he missed the entire MLB season 2024. It's just so sad.
Yeah, I think what that means to me is they didn't see a whole lot on the MRI. I think they do an MRI almost immediately with major league pitchers. And he had an anterior capsular repair a year and a half ago. And basically what they're saying there is it's not retorn, which is a great thing. So they're calling it inflammation. You can see a little increased signal maybe in the front of the shoulder, and that's what they see. But to me, that means they didn't see much else, which is, I think, a pretty good sign.
So the surgery that you mentioned, he's had a rough couple of years. Does that make it more likely that what he's suffering from now could have happened? Are they completely unrelated? Can we tie the two together in any way?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, these things add up. Pitcher's arm is under so much stress. This capsular repair, it tries to reconnect the spring on the inside of the shoulder that holds it stable, but also allows it to kind of wind up energy and then retransmit energy through the ball. It's not normal. You know, we repair these things and we make them better, but it's not normal. And there's probably increased rigidity and lost elasticity when they're repaired. But obviously it was decent because he was doing pretty well for a while. I think that what people have to understand is that pitching is one of the highest stress things that humans do. There's nothing else that has more rotational speed in that we've studied in human behavior or human sports than a baseball pitcher. When they throw, their arm is spinning so fast that if it kept going, it would go all the way around 20 times in 1 second. So just trying to imagine that is kind of hard to, it's sort of hard to get your brain around. So
wow.
There's just such tight tolerances to getting a fastball or a breaking pitch to go that fast and on target that it doesn't take much to kind of upset things.
My gosh. It's like a slingshot. So what do you think his long term, like when, after pitchers are done, when they're retired, I remember interviewing a Cubs pitcher. He was describing how he was still awake and he was doing some surgery on his forearm. And his wife said she could never eat spaghetti ever again. I mean, what happens to their limbs?
Yeah, so their shoulders see a ton of stress. Their elbows see a ton of stress. Is he 33, I think? I mean, he's a realist. He's a pretty smart guy. He knows that's generally close to the back end of a pitcher's career, and he's had a surgery and a couple of setbacks. So he knows there's not that many pitches left in his arm, but I think if there's nothing wrong on the MRI, makes sense to just watch and wait and see what his arm can do in 2 or 3 weeks.
How tough is it mentally to get through this? He had a major surgery. He went through the rehab. He came back. Things seem to be going well. When an elite athlete has a setback like this, how difficult is the mental part of it?
It's a big thing. I see a lot of athletes, college kids, professional athletes, and they're just like any other group. There's more variation within groups than between groups, if that makes sense. So some of them are super resilient and super relaxed, and some of them are forgive the pun, wound pretty tight and anxious. So he seems like a pretty relaxed individual, but you never know. So it's a lot to deal with. There's a lot riding on their success and their ability to throw a pitch. So it's stressful. It's definitely stressful.
Dr. Patrick Yost is the guy. If you're ever throwing a 100-mile-an-hour fastball and your velocity goes down to 85, Julia, Dr. Yost is the guy you want to deal
with.
He
is my man.
Yeah, he's going to take care of you.
I'll be available. Thank you.
Orthopedic Hospital of Wisconsin is the place. They're the best in the business. Dr. Yost, thank you so much. Have a great weekend. 442
Bye.
WTMJ, traffic and weather up next.
This is WTMJ's.
All right, you can always watch the show by texting the word watch to 855-616-1620 or catch the show on YouTube. Just search for 620 WTMJ on YouTube and you can watch the show. Brian Jacobson, you can watch him right now. He's the chief economist for Annex Wealth Management,
look
one of the smartest
Brian.
Guys we know. You look good, Brian.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
So today, the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ jumped to record highs once again. What led to the good news this week? Because it was a really good week for the markets.
It really was. It seems like the market really kind of brushed off some of the concerns that we have about Iran, also the transition of leadership at the Fed. And really this week, it was all about the earnings. And I think that's really the key message here. Coming into earnings season, where a lot of businesses, right, they're reporting their results for the first quarter. Coming in, the average estimate from FactSet said that we should see 13, maybe 14% earnings growth year over year. We're coming in at a 27% rate. So 84% of the companies that have reported have actually exceeded expectations. And I think that's really the story here, is that corporate America has just proved that they can do a pretty good job, that despite the chaos in the world, they can still kind of, you know, print some profits.
Okay. What about the oil prices, though?
Yeah, that is the hard part, and that's what we're struggling with as consumers. Corporate America isn't quite as sensitive to oil prices as what consumers are. We got plenty of data this past week showing the pain that a lot of people are feeling. We know the nationwide average price of gasoline is above $4.30, and when we look at different income cohorts. It's really hitting those individuals who are in the lowest income cohort. Ever since last year, the amount that people have spent on gasoline has gone up 21%. So just imagine if you don't have the savings or the credit availability, and you actually have to make some of those tough decisions about how do you reallocate your budget in the face of gasoline that's forcing you to spend about 21% more than you did a year ago.
Yeah, those are big numbers. Brian Jacobson is with us, chief economist at Annex Wealth Management. So, Brian, you raise a really interesting point about how the market figures in the oil and gas prices versus the consumer, the person who's just trying to buy groceries and take their kids to school. What about when the two collide? Like, I read that airlines in Europe are cutting flights because jet fuel is so expensive. Trucking companies are worried about their outlook because diesel fuel is so expensive. How does the market bake in when those things collide?
Yeah, it really does affect the market, but in different ways. So overall, businesses are pretty adaptable as far as managing this. Some airlines decide that they're going to hedge that risk, and so they can lock in those prices. Most of those in the United States haven't done that just because we had this nice long period of time where oil prices were fairly low. So it is affecting the airline industry. It's also the cruise line industry, right? And when we then get into shipping, anything that you consume physically got to you somehow, right? You either went and got it, or when it got to the store, right, it got shipped there, it gets shipped to your house. So we do see oil prices feed into the price of the items that we purchase, but it's not the full price. Right. There's a lot of other things that go into it. And the economy as a whole is a lot less actually energy intensive than what it used to be. I mean, just for some perspective, when we look back at, to say, the year 2000, economic output is about 40% higher than what it was back then. But the total volume of what we consume in terms of energy is only up about 7 to 10%. Right. So we're becoming much more efficient as time goes on. So it's very visible and you can feel it, but it doesn't have the same economic effect as it did just 20 years ago.
Yeah, and over the years, bailouts, what may happen in the future, the appetite, is it still there?
Yeah.
Okay, so right now, Spirit Airlines, 53 minutes ago, NBC News just reported it could shut down as soon as tomorrow, according to a source. Do you think that they could get bailed out?
I don't think so. I'm not sure that there's the appetite for a bailout. You know, what would be the justification? Most of the time, bailouts happen when it's for companies that are viewed as what's called systemically important, that is important to the entire system. And when you look at the market share of a company like Spirit, you know, maybe they could have a prepackaged bankruptcy where they get gobbled up by somebody else pretty rapidly. It would be very different if it was a bigger airline where all of a sudden it would be incredibly disruptive. Now, obviously, disruptive for the employees, the shareholders, and passengers. But for the most part, when you look at their market share, last time I looked, it was only about like 3%. So I don't think that there'd be a good rationale to do it on a sort of a national security or systemic risk perspective.
Brian Jacobson, Annex Wealth Management, is with us. So Brian, every day on the show as part of our Annex Wealth Management market update, we give the numbers, either where they are or where they closed for the NASDAQ, the S&P 500, and the Dow. For the average person out there who has conventional retirement accounts and a 401k and doesn't buy a lot of individual stocks, which of those numbers in general more broadly reflects how their portfolio is likely to be doing? Can you kind of take us inside the three indexes and how they work?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great question. And really, it starts with the Dow is the most narrow. So that's only about 30 stocks. And it is chosen by a committee where they want it to represent the overall economy. So it's only 30 stocks, which is diversified, but not as diversified as most people's retirement plans are. Then when we look at the NASDAQ, you actually have a lot more stocks there than what you have in the Dow, but it is much more focused on technology companies. And then you get the S&P 500. So that's 500 stocks, a lot more diversified in terms of the sector representation. So I would say that as far as which one is the better benchmark for how you're in or what your experience might be, when it comes to the equity side of things, it's probably the S&P 500. But keep in mind, your retirement plan probably also has bonds in there, right? It's most likely a balanced portfolio of some sort. When you're younger, maybe you're in a target date fund where it starts with a very high allocation to equities because you have a long runway in front of you. As you get closer to retirement, it probably shifts more and more into bonds, and then you reach like a cruising altitude as far as that stock and bond mix. So you really do have to, I think, look at it as far as log into the system. It probably identifies what a benchmark is for your overall portfolio. So it can be a little distracting to look, you know, watch CNBC and Fox Business News and all those other networks where you can see the tickers. That might not actually reflect your actual investment experience.
So what I have with Annex Wealth Management is an account where if I were to retire in 2055,
yeah,
that's what I did.
A targeted account. Nice. I have one of my majors account is that too, mm-hmm. except yep. mine's sooner than yours.
yours is in like 2027.
It is not.
And mine's in like 55 years. Oh, Brian.
Hey, Brian, can I ask you about a specific stock?
Yeah.
So my accountant, Annex, I came into a little bit of money, and I bought $1,000 worth of a specific stock, so not a lot of money. Spent $1,000. It's the first specific freestanding stock I ever bought.
You're joking.
My Annex advisor said, I want to do something fun and different. He said, well, what are you interested in? I said, I just got back from a cruise. He said, all right. I bought Carnival stock in 2019 when it was $58 a share in 2019. Well, we know what happened, right? The pandemic happened and stocks went, this thing went down to like $1 a share. So I held on to it because who cares, you know? And now it's at $28 a share. How do you assess when you have one stock, you haven't spent a lot of money, and whether you hold it, whether you get rid of it, how do you talk through and work through that?
So the way that we do it is oftentimes, you know, if you're going to do it for fun, you have to realize that you're taking on a lot of risk. In a way, you almost treat it more like it's a game than yep. actual investing, right? So we always think about it in terms of the diversified portfolio. When we look at individual stocks, we want to understand the fundamentals of the businesses that we're investing in, which means not just understanding the business, but its competitors, also its entire industry. Then it's about the valuation, because price is what you pay, but value is what you get. And so what is the valuation of it? What is our view about will those fundamentals likely improve? Do we think that actually the market is underappreciating some of the growth potential there? But then you wrap it in risk management. And the risk management, in this case, I would say that, well, maybe it's a 2 to 4% position as opposed to the 100% position. But you kept it in one account, right? I mean, you right. kept it segregated. And so it's not as though it has derailed your financial plan by any stretch of the imagination.
Annex Wealth Management's Brian Jacobson. He is the chief economist. Always good to catch up. Have a great weekend, Brian.
Yes, you too. Thank you so much.